Today is Wednesday, June 23rd, and you're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, President Biden steps up efforts to vaccinate younger Americans.
The reality is many younger Americans have felt like COVID-19 is not something that impacts them, and they've been less eager to get the shot.
Plus, a coalition of 41 countries demand access to suspected Uyghur camps in China.
Norton urged China on behalf of the coalition to allow immediate, unfettered access to Xinjiang for independent observers.
Also, UN report accuses Eritrea of gross rights abuses in Tigray. Our top story today is in the U.S. The Biden administration is stepping up efforts to vaccinate young Americans for COVID-19, as the White House acknowledges it will miss a key goal of partially or fully vaccinating 70% of adults by the July 14th Independence Day holiday. VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Jepson has more.
In the U.S., COVID-19 case numbers are down to the lowest level since March 2020. But those encouraging numbers are coming as the White House announces it will not reach an early July goal of vaccinating 70% of all American adults. One problem? Younger Americans. White House COVID-19 response coordinator Jeff Zients.
The country has more work to do, is particularly with 18 to 26-year-olds. The reality is many younger Americans have felt like COVID-19 is not something that impacts them, and they've been less eager to get the shot.
The White House has announced Tuesday that 70% of Americans over age 30 have been partially or fully vaccinated. And while the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says vaccination rates have increased in communities of color in recent weeks, U.S. lawmakers say more work needs to be done. Democratic Senator Patty Murray.
We will not reach the goals in many states and communities if we do not continue to address the hesitancy, misinformation, and other issues holding back Americans from getting vaccinated. We have to continue increasing access and addressing barriers which make it hard for people to get vaccines, especially for people of color.
And with nearly half of American evangelical Christians saying they will not take the vaccine, one theologian told lawmakers that hesitancy has a worldwide impact. Duke Divinity School professor Curtis Chang.
And at the global level, American evangelical culture is highly influential in parts of Asia and Africa. We're already exporting our misinformation and fears to the rest of the world, especially via social media.
Even with 20 to 30% of American adults unvaccinated, U.S. officials are optimistic there will not be a fourth surge of the coronavirus in the U.S. this winter. Director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, Dr. Anthony Fauci.
I don't think even under those circumstances that you're going to see things like 1,000 deaths a day. I think that is a bit much. But there is a danger, a real danger, that if there is a persistence of a recalcitrance to getting vaccinated, that you could see localized surges.
And as the U.S. was working to raise its own vaccination rates, the White House said earlier this week that its goal of sharing 80 million vaccine doses globally by the end of June is being complicated by logistical challenges. Catherine Jepson, VOA News, Washington.
Several weeks after the U.S. Senate blocked legislation to form a bipartisan commission to investigate the attack on the U.S. Capitol, the House is planning to act. AP correspondent Jackie Quinn reports.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi told Democratic colleagues she is creating a new committee to investigate the deadly January 6th incursion at the U.S. Capitol. That's according to an inside source familiar with her remarks, which were made at a private leadership meeting. This new House committee will be formed after Senate Republicans rejected a bipartisan panel to investigate the attack waged by supporters of former President Trump. Jackie Quinn, Washington.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has arrived in Germany on the first stop on a European tour that would also take him to Paris, Rome, and the Vatican, as well as the Italian cities of Bari and Matera. He will attend a summit to discuss a range of bilateral issues and attend meetings on Libya and combating the Islamic State terrorist group. VOA's senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reports from Washington.
Blinken, a strong supporter of transatlantic ties, is getting the red carpet treatment. He will meet with heads of state and government at all three stops, where climate change and the COVID-19 pandemic will be a constant focus. In Berlin, countering anti-Semitism and Holocaust denial will be on the agenda. Blinken will also attend the second Berlin conference on Libya, where Libyan delegates will be at the table for the first time. Expert Brian Katulis says Libya's future is looking brighter.
The main issue there is that unlike Syria or even Yemen, there actually has been substantial progress on the ground to try to pull together the different factions. And even in recent days, efforts to open up supply lines to get humanitarian aid in.
The growing threat posed by Islamic State terrorists in Africa and Afghanistan will be a central theme of the meeting in Rome by the Coalition to Defeat ISIS. Dealing with China is likely to be an issue at each stop, and perceptions over the challenge Beijing poses differ, says analyst Dan Hamilton.
The Europeans tend to speak of it as a systemic rival. The Biden administration has said adversary. So there are some wording differences here that reflect a bit difference in how sharp you want to be with the Chinese on challenges.
Another common thread of the trip is likely to be the rising threat to democracy around the world. Biden and Blinken have not shied away from uncomfortable conversations about real threats to democracy at home and abroad, says Jonathan Katz of the German Marshall Fund.
Frankly, at every moment since January, when the president took over, democracy has been front and center in almost every conversation. Diplomatic, you know, press releases, communiques.
The threat to democracy from authoritarian leaders is real, warns the European Union ambassador to the United States, Stavros Lambrinidis.
It's not just the two of us in the world today. There are others trying to break the notion that democracy and freedom is a good thing. And in some cases, they're succeeding. Well, they have to stand up and listen because the EU and the U.S. are now together in the same room, and we are going to stop them.
Lambrinidis expressed confidence the United States and the European Union will do the hard work required to address the underlying social and economic issues that contribute to anti-democratic movements. Cindy Sane, VOA News, Washington.
Analysts say Turkey is expected to come under pressure to remove its military from Libya when world leaders gather Wednesday at a conference in Berlin. The meeting will include discussions on elections and the withdrawal of foreign forces from the war-torn North African country. For VOA, Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
Wednesday's Berlin conference is the second international meeting organized by Germany and the United Nations. Discussions will be on permanently ending the Libyan civil war and preparations for December elections. A key goal of the gathering is the creation of a framework for the withdrawal of all foreign fighters, something Aya Buela, a visiting lecturer at the Hellenic National Defense College, says is key to restoring stability.
Good governance, very difficult to establish in Libya. There's arms everywhere, militias everywhere, there's no rule of law. So the presence of foreign powers has really undermined that. So Libyans want them all out. They want to have a normal country. Most of all, they want to have elections at the end of the year.
Turkey deployed hundreds of soldiers and thousands of Syrian fighters in support of the Libyan government of national accord in its battle against forces of Libya's General Khalifa Haftar, who is backed by Russian and Sudanese mercenaries. A ceasefire is now in force. While backing calls for the removal of foreign troops, Ankara says its presence is legitimate because it was invited by the internationally recognized government. But with conference attendees, including EU members and the United States, calling for the removal of all foreign troops and Turkey seeking to improve ties with its Western allies, international relations professor Serhat Güvenç of Istanbul's Kadahas University says Ankara will likely acquiesce, at least in part.
Turkey will probably eventually come to terms with the fact that it has to, you know, take those foreign fighters from Libya, you know, the Syrian, the fighters, you know, the Turkish proxies.
A U.S. Defense Department report last year said Turkey sent thousands of paid Syrian fighters to Libya. Buela says the mercenaries are among the most destabilizing forces in Libya.
These Syrian mercenaries, their behavior in Libya is very much the same as their behavior in northeast Syria. looting, sexual assaults, violence. And there's something very jarring about natives seeing foreign men with arms, you know, driving around their streets, you know, no accountability.
Ankara denies such claims of misconduct. Turkey's wider military presence is also expected to come under pressure. The Turkish military constructed an airbase and wants to establish a naval base in Libya, a plan opposed by Egypt and France, which are also attending the Berlin conference. But Güvenç says Ankara sees its Libyan military presence as having strategic importance.
Turkey has to keep a foot in Africa, that air force base or air base in Alvatia. In Libya, indeed, offers tremendous opportunities in that regard. So probably Turkey will bargain really hard to keep its presence, keep that base.
Analysts say the Berlin conference sees Ankara working to balance its strategic goals of improving ties with its Western allies while expanding its influence in Africa. Dorian Jones of VOA News, Istanbul.
A coalition of 41 countries is calling for access to internment camps in China's Xinjiang region to check on the situation of an estimated 1 million Muslim Uyghurs who allegedly have been detained under abusive conditions. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Canada issued the cross-regional joint statement at the UN Human Rights Council Tuesday. In her delivery, Ottawa's ambassador to the United Nations in Geneva, Leslie Norton, stressed the urgency of getting to the bottom of this human rights situation.
Credible reports indicate that over 1 million people have been arbitrarily detained in Xinjiang and that there's widespread surveillance disproportionately targeting Uyghurs and members of other minorities and restrictions on fundamental freedoms in Uyghur culture. There are also reports of torture or cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment or punishment, forced sterilization, sexual and gender-based violence, and forced separation of children from their parents by authorities.
Norton urged China on behalf of the coalition to allow immediate, unfettered access to Xinjiang for independent observers, including the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights. This follows a similar request made by Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet at the opening of the council session Monday.
I continue to discuss with China modalities for a visit, including meaningful access to the Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region, and hope this can be achieved this year, particularly as reports of serious human rights violations continue to emerge.
Beijing has described the detention camps as vocational centers aimed at stopping religious extremism and terrorist attacks. China said it welcomes a visit by the High Commissioner to China, including Xinjiang, but on condition that it be a friendly visit and not a so-called investigation under the presumption of guilt. China also responded quite differently to the joint statement that demanded access to the camps in Xinjiang. Minister Jian Duan simply ignored it. Instead, he conveyed his deep concern about the serious human rights violations suffered by indigenous people in Canada. His statement was supported by 7 countries: Russia, Belarus, North Korea, Venezuela, Iran, Syria, and Sri Lanka.
Historically, Canada robbed the indigenous people of their land, killed them, and eradicated their culture. We call for a thorough and impartial investigation into all cases where crimes were committed against the indigenous people, especially the children.
The Canadian ambassador acknowledged that indigenous people still face systemic racism, discrimination, and injustice, but added her government was working to right these wrongs. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Hong Kong's pro-democracy tabloid Apple Daily said it will print its last edition on Thursday, after a tumultuous year in which it was raided by police and its tycoon owner and other staff were arrested under a new national security law. Emily Wither, Reuters, reports.
The paper mixes pro-democracy discourse with racy celebrity gossip and investigations of those in power. Its closure has escalated alarm over media freedom and other rights in the Chinese-ruled city. Apple Daily said the decision was based on employee safety and manpower considerations. The paper's publisher, Next Digital, said in a statement the decision to close the newspaper, which employs about 600 journalists, was taken due to the current circumstances prevailing in Hong Kong. Police last week froze assets of companies linked to the newspaper and arrested five executives. Authorities have said dozens of Apple Daily pieces may have violated the security law, which Beijing imposed on the city last year. Rights groups, media organizations, and Western governments have criticized last week's police raid on the newspaper.
That's Emily Wither of Reuters. Iran's newly elected president has voiced support for the 2015 nuclear deal his country signed and promised to stabilize relations with Arab neighbors in the Gulf region. Henry Ridgewell reports on what the world can expect from President-elect Ebrahim Raisi.
Iran's president-elect Ebrahim Raisi is a regime loyalist and a long-standing critic of the West. He was active in Iran's 1979 Islamic Revolution and rose to the top of the judiciary. But the office of president will not reward him with real political power, says analyst Alex Vatanka, Iran program director at the Middle East Institute in Washington.
Will he be able to shift course, take the country in a different direction? Absolutely not. He just doesn't have that power.
Instead, that power resides with Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. Khamenei, through his protege Raisi, has expressed support for resurrecting the 2015 Iran nuclear deal, known as the JCPOA. Former U.S. President Donald Trump withdrew from the accord in 2018. Accord critics say Washington should be wary of rejoining. Behnam Bentaleblu is from the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies in Washington.
I think Khamenei is comfortable now dispensing with the fig leaf of moderation, dispensing with the mask, and does not even appear content to make cosmetic changes to the Islamic Republic because he knows U.S. interest in resurrecting the JCPOA is so high.
Nuclear talks in Vienna between Iran and six world powers were adjourned Sunday. Raisi will likely appoint a new team of negotiators, but there won't be major changes to Iran's foreign policy, says Vatanka.
The Iranians are not going to pack up and leave Vienna just because he's a president-elect. He has mentioned China, that he's very keen on continuing the 25-year strategic deal, which was signed back in March with the Chinese. Whatever that means, we'll wait and see.
Raisi has said he will seek to stabilize relations with Arab rivals in the region. Again, Alex Vatanka.
Maybe Riyadh and Abu Dhabi and others in the Arab world will take Raisi a little bit more seriously because they think he's a front man for Ayatollah Khamenei.
Rights groups say Raisi was one of four judges who oversaw executions of thousands of political prisoners in 1988. He remains under U.S. sanctions. Again, Behnam Bentaleblu.
Engaging with a regime that has someone who oversaw mass executions in Tehran in the late 1980s is not going to be the most wise course of action for Washington.
Ultimately, it will be the Iranian people who will mobilize to determine the country's future, says French-Iranian analyst Manaz Shirali.
I think we are not far from seeing demonstrations. I think that Iranian society is pregnant with deep movements within itself. So I think that following this election, we can expect to find a people who have gained confidence in their ability to act, to not put up with so much injustice.
But under President Raisi, analysts predict the Iranian regime will continue to crush any sign of political dissent. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
This is the Voice of America. An Iranian news site close to security services say authorities have thwarted a, quote, sabotage attack, unquote, on the country's civilian nuclear program without providing further information. Nor News, a website believed to be close to Iran's Supreme National Security Council, reported Wednesday that the attack was thwarted, quote, before causing any damage to the building, unquote. You are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. A report submitted to the UN Human Rights Council accuses the Eritrean government of involvement in Ethiopia's conflict in the Tigray region and of committing serious human rights violations against Eritreans who have sought asylum in Tigray. We have Lisa Schlein again reporting for VOA from Geneva.
The special rapporteur on the human rights situation in Eritrea, Mohamed Abdel Salam Babiker, is new to the job, although in 2017 he was part of a UN monitoring team that imposed sanctions on the country. In this, his first report since he started his mandate in November, he pulls no punches. He presents a grim picture of a government that perpetrates gross human rights violations with impunity, both at home and abroad.
There are no tangible signs of progress or concrete evidence of improvement in the internal human rights situation in Eritrea. In addition, Eritrea extended its human rights violations extraterritorially or beyond its borders during this mandate and committed heinous human rights violations in the Tigray region of Ethiopia.
Babiker says he has received allegations that Eritrean troops in Tigray carried out deliberate attacks against civilians, summary executions, sexual and gender-based violence. He says they also allegedly took part in the abduction and disappearance of Eritrean refugees and asylum seekers. He expresses particular concern about the reported destruction by Eritrean troops of two refugee camps in Hitsats and Shimbela in northern Tigray, which hosted more than 25,000 Eritrean refugees. The refugee camps are located near the two countries' borders.
I call on the Eritrean authorities to withdraw their forces from Tigray to provide information about the whereabouts of the missing Eritrean refugees and to release any Eritrean refugees held in detention.
Turning to the situation inside Eritrea, Babiker says the only positive news he has to report is of the release of more than 100 Muslims, Orthodox Christians, and Jehovah's Witnesses who were detained without charges and trial, some for over 20 years. He's urging the government to release all political prisoners and prisoners of conscience who are being held incommunicado for indefinite periods under inhumane conditions. In his response to Babiker, Ambassador Tesfamikael Geratu of Eritrea's Ministry of Foreign Affairs made no reference to Eritrean troop presence in Ethiopia. He rejected the report, calling it politicized. He called into question the legitimacy of the special rapporteur's mandate and told the council it should be abolished. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The World Health Organization has said it is setting up a, quote, tech transfer hub, unquote, in South Africa so that companies from poor and middle-income countries can access the technology to manufacture the most advanced COVID-19 vaccines. Oki Okoha of Reuters has more.
The World Health Organization is setting up a hub in South Africa to share advanced vaccine know-how with companies from poor and middle-income countries.
WHO is in discussions with a consortium of companies.
The tech transfer hub could make it possible for African companies to begin manufacturing mRNA vaccines in as little as 9 months, the WHO said. That is the advanced method used in shots from Pfizer and Moderna. At a WHO briefing on Monday, South African President Cyril Ramaphosa called it an historic step to spread life-saving technology.
Through this initiative and others, we will change the narrative of an Africa that is a center of disease and poor development.
But Ramaphosa continued his call for a waiver to intellectual property rules around vaccines, something that South Africa and India have been pushing for at the WTO.
It's been shown now that we just cannot continue to rely on vaccines that are made outside of Africa because they never come. They never arrive on time and people continue to die.
The WHO said it is in talks with Pfizer and Moderna about participating in the hub. The two pharmaceutical companies have been manufacturing vaccines in wealthier countries using mRNA technology. Two South African companies have signed up for the hub so far, the WHO said. Afrigen Biologics, described as a development company, and BioVac, described as a manufacturer.
That's Oki Okoha of Reuters. That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Pound Dawson. I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. Thank you so much for listening and have a great evening.